This is Chapter 3, Tenants In and Out. Upstairs in 3D, Angela Wexler stood on a hassock as still and blank-faced pretty as a store window dummy. Her pale blue eyes stared unblinkingly at the lake. "Turn, dear," said Flora Baumbach, the dressmaker who lived and worked in a small apartment on the second floor. Angela pivoted in a slow quarter turn. Oh! Startled by the small cry, Flora Baumbach dropped the pin from her pudgy fingers and almost swallowed the three in her mouth. "Please be careful, Mrs. Baumbach. My Angela has very delicate skin." Grace Windsor Wexler was supervising the fitting of her daughter's wedding dress from the beige velvet couch. Above her hung the 24 framed flower prints she had selected and arranged with the greatest of taste and care. She could have been an interior decorator, a good one, too, if it wasn't for the pressing demands of so on and so forth. "Mrs. Baumbach didn't prick me, Mother," Angela said evenly. "I was just surprised to see smoke coming from the Westinghouse chimney." Crawling with slow caution on her hands and knees, Flora Baumbach paused in the search for the drop pin to peer up through her straight gray bangs. Mrs. Wexler set her coffee cup on the driftwood coffee table and craned her neck for a better view. "You must have new neighbors. I'll have to drive up there with a housewarming gift. They may need some decorating advice." "Hey, look, there's smoke coming from the Westinghouse." Again, Turtle was late with the news. "Oh, it's you." Mrs. Wexler always seemed surprised to see her other daughter, so unlike golden-haired, angel-faced Angela. Flora Baumbach, about to rise with the found pin, quickly sank down again to protect her sore shin in the shag carpeting. She had pulled Turtle's braid in the lobby yesterday. "Otis Amber says that old man Westing's stinking corpse is rotting on an oriental rug." "My, oh my!" Flora Baumbach exclaimed, and Mrs. Wexler clicked her tongue in an irritated tisk. Turtle decided not to go on with the horror story. Not that her mother cared if she got killed or ended up a raving lunatic. "Mrs. Baumbach, could you hem my witch's costume? I need it for tonight." Mrs. Wexler answered, "Can't you see she's busy with Angela's wedding dress? And why must you wear a silly costume like that? Really, Turtle, I don't know why you insist on making yourself ugly." "It's no sillier than a wedding dress," Turtle snapped back. "Besides, nobody gets married anymore, and if they do, they don't wear silly wedding dresses." She was close to a tantrum. "Besides, who would want to marry that stuck-up, know-it-all, marshmallow-faced Dr. Denton?" "That's enough out of your smart mouth," Mrs. Wexler leaped up, hand ready to strike. Instead, she straightened a framed flower print, powdered her fashionably honey-blonde hairdo, and sat down again. She had never hit Turtle, but one of these days... Besides, a stranger was present. "Dr. Deer is a brilliant young man," she explained for Flora Baumbach's ears. The dressmaker smiled politely. "Angela will soon be Angela Deer. Isn't that a precious name?" The dressmaker nodded. "And then we'll have two doctors in the family. Now, where do you think you're going?" Turtle was at the front door. "Downstairs to tell Daddy about the smoke coming from the Westinghouse." "Come back this instant. You know your father operates in the afternoon. Why don't you go to your room and work on stock market reports or whatever else you do in there?" "Some room. It's even too small for a closet." "I'll hem your witch's costume, Turtle," Angela offered. Mrs. Wexler beamed on her perfect child, draped in white. What an angel. Crow's clothes were black, her skin dead white. She looked severe, rigid, in fact. Rigid and righteously severe. No one could have guessed that under that stern facade, her stomach was doing flip-flops as Dr. Wexler cut out a corn. Staring down at the fine lines of pink scalp that showed through the podiatrist's thinning brown hair did nothing to ease her queasiness. So, softly humming a hymn, She settled her gaze on the north window. Smoke. Watch it. Jake Wexler almost cut off her little toe along with the corn. Unaware of the near amputation, the cleaning woman stared at the Westinghouse. If you will just sit back, Jake began, but his patient did not hear him. She must have been a handsome woman at one time, but life had used her harshly. Her faded hair, knotted in a tight bun on the nape of her gaunt neck, glinted gold red in the light. Her profile was fine, marred only by the jut of her clenched jaw. Well, let's get on with it. Friday was his busy day, and he had phone calls to make. Please sit back, Mrs. Crow. I'm almost finished. What? Jake gently replaced her foot on the chair's pedestal. I see you've hurt your shin. What? For an instant, their eyes met. Then she looked away. A shy creature, or a guilty one. Crow averted her face when she spoke. Your daughter Turtle kicked me, she muttered, staring once again at the Westinghouse. That's what happens when there is no religion in the home. Sandy says Westing's corpse is up there, rotting away on an oriental rug, but I don't believe it. If he's truly dead, then he's roasting in hell. We are all sinners. All. What do you mean his corpse is rotting on an oriental rug? Some kind of Persian rug? Maybe a Chinese rug? Mr. Hu joined his son at the glass sidewall of the fifth floor restaurant. And why were you wasting precious time listening to an overage delivery boy with an overactive imagination when you should have been studying? It was not a question. Doug's father never asked questions. Don't shrug at me. Go study. Sure, Dad. Doug jogged off through the kitchen. It was no use arguing that there was no school tomorrow, just track practice. He jogged down the back stairs. No matter what excuse he gave, go study, his father would say. Go study. He jogged into the Who's rear apartment, stretched out on the bare floor, and repeated, go study, to 27. Only two customers were expected for the dinner hour. Shin Hu's restaurant could seat 100. Mr. Hu slammed the reservations book shut, pressed a hand against the pain in his ample stomach, unwrapped a chocolate bar and devoured it quickly before acid etched another ulcer. Back home again, he is. Oh, wait, sorry. Back home again, is he? Well, Westing won't get off so easy this time. Not on his life. A small, delicate woman in a long white apron stood in silence before the restaurant's east window. She stared longingly into the boundless gray distance as if far, far on the other side of Lake Michigan lay China. Sandy McSouthers saluted as the maroon Mercedes swung around the curved driveway and came to a stop at the entrance. He opened the car door with a ceremony reserved only for Judge J.J. Ford. Look up there, Judge. There's smoke coming from the Westinghouse. A tall black woman in a tailored suit, her short clipped hair touched with gray, slipped out from behind the wheel, handed the car keys to the doorman, and cast a disinterested glance at the house on the hill. They say nobody's up there, just the corpse of old man Westing rotting away on an oriental rug, Sandy reported as he hoisted a full briefcase from the trunk of the car. Do you believe in ghosts, Judge? There is certain to be a more rational explanation. You're right, of course, Judge. Sandy opened the heavy glass door and followed on the judge's heels through the lobby. I was just repeating what Otis Amber said. Otis Amber is a stupid man, if not downright mad. J.J. Ford hurried into the elevator. She should not have said that. Not her. Not the first black, the first woman, to have been elected to a judgeship in the state. She was tired after a trying day. That was it. Or was it? So Sam Westing has come home at last. Well, she could sell the car, take out a bank loan, pay him back in cash. But would he take it? Please, don't repeat what I said about Otis Amber, Mr. McSouthers. Don't worry, Judge. Doorman escorted her to the door of apartment 4D. What you tell me is strictly confidential. And it was. J.J. Ford was the biggest tipper in Sunset Towers. I saw some... Chris Theodorakis was too excited to stutter out the news to his brother. One arm shot out and twisted up over his head. Dumb arm. Theo squatted next to the wheelchair. Listen, Chris, I'll tell you about that haunted castle on the hill. His voice was soothing and hushed in mystery. Somebody is up there, Chris, but nobody is there. Just rich Mr. Westing, and he's dead. Dead as a squashed June bug and rotting away on a moth-eaten oriental rug. Chris relaxed as he always did when his brother told him a story. Theo was good at making up stories. And the worms are crawling in and out of the dead man's skull, in and out of his ears holes, his nose holes, his mouth holes, in and out of all of his holes. Chris laughed, then quickly composed his face. He was supposed to look scared. Theo leaned closer, and high above the putrid corpse, a crystal chandelier is tinkling. It tinkles and twinkles, but not one breath of air stirs in that gloomy tomb of a room. Gloomy tomb of a room. Theo will make a good writer someday, Chris thought. He wouldn't spoil this wonderful, spooky Halloween story by telling him about the real person up there, the one with the limp. So Chris sat quietly, his body at ease, and heard about ghosts and ghouls and purple waves, and smiled at his brother with pure delight. A smile that could break your heart, Sadel Pulaski, the tenant in 3C, always said. But no one paid any attention to Sadel Pulaski. Sadel Pulaski struggled out of the taxi, large end first. She was not a heavy woman, just wide-hipped from years of secretarial sitting. If only there was a ladylike way to get out of a cab. Her green rhinestone-studded glasses slipped down her fleshy nose as she grappled with a tall triangular package and a stuffed shopping bag. If only that lazy driver would lend her a hand. Not for a nickel tip, he wouldn't. The cabbie slammed the black door and sped around the curved driveway, narrowly missing the Mercedes that Sandy was driving to the parking lot. At least the never there when you need him doorman had propped open the front door. Not that he ever helped her, or noticed her for that matter. No one ever noticed. Sadel Pulaski limped through the lobby. She could be carrying a high-powered rifle in that package, and no one would notice. She had moved to Sunset Towers hoping to meet elegant people, but no one had invited her in for so much as a cup of tea. No one paid any attention to her, except that poor crippled boy whose smile could break your heart, and that bratty kid with the braid. She'll be sorry she kicked her in the shin. Juggling her load, earrings jingling and charm bracelet jangling, Sadel Pulaski unlocked the several locks to apartment 3C and bolted the door behind her. There'd be fewer burglaries around here if people listened to her about putting in deadbolt locks. But nobody listened. Nobody cared. On the plastic-covered dining table, she set out the contents of the shopping bag. 6 cans of enamel, paint thinner, and brushes. She had wrapped a long package and leaned 4 wooden crutches against the wall. The sun was setting over the parking lot, but Sadel Pulaski did not look out her back window. From the side window, smoke could be seen rising from the Westinghouse. But Sadel Pulaski did not notice. No one ever notices Sadel Pulaski, she muttered. But they will now. They will now. This ends chapter 3 of The Westing Game.